Okay. First thing I want to do is do a little bit of reviewing to make sure we're... Every once in a while, when you've done this much, it's good to look at it as a block and get the... Okay. So, if you remember, Isaac was older now, and Jacob was in the line of blessing, the line of the seed. So Isaac told Jacob not to marry one of the women near where he lived, because that would pollute the line of the seed and jeopardize the Abrahamic covenant. So he didn't want him to marry a Canaanite woman. And in doing so, he would protect the covenant with the forefathers. And, you know, one of the things that Satan has always wanted, among the things he's always wanted to do, was to eradicate the Jewish people. And there's two ways he's tried to do it. Actually, I guess you could say three. There's a third way I can think of. One way is just have them be destroyed, like at the Holocaust. Another way, yeah, really two ways. Another way would be to have them intermingle with another people. And that can sometimes, if you have two people groups, and let's say one is larger than the other, although that's not definitive, but if you have two people groups, and one of the people groups goes and starts to intermarry with the other, that first people group can lose its identity. See? And so Satan, on a number of occasions, tried to have the Jewish people not destroyed as in the Holocaust, but just eradicate their identity as a separate chosen people. And if you'll notice, he, of course, has not been successful, but it's not for lack of trying. And the Bible teaches us clearly on this. You know, for example, you know the story of when Dinah, who was Jacob's daughter, was raped? And the man who raped her loved her, although that's hard for me to understand that one, but he loved her. And he went to his father and he said to his father, "I'd like to marry this woman. Will you go talk to her father?" So they went and they talked, and Jacob's sons were quite devious. The man who came to speak with actually Jacob's sons first convinced his people this would be good for them. It would expand them. They would prosper. You know, Jacob had a reputation as being a prosperous man, very wealthy. So he saw this as a good strategic move. Plus, he wanted his son to have the woman he wanted. Of course, what the sons of Jacob did was they foiled that. They told him, "We'll marry and live with you and so forth and so on, but all your males have to be circumcised." And they agreed to that. And then shortly after all the males were circumcised, and there's not really much you can do for a number of days after you're circumcised. I mean, a baby, you really don't notice it because they're just going to lie there anyway. But if an adult is really circumcised, you're out of it for a week or two. You know. And so while they were still in pain, the brothers, the sons of Jacob, to avenge the taking of Dinah's honor, went and destroyed the city, killed all the men in the city. And they were defenseless. They couldn't fight. But what we can see here, though, is aside from everything else that was going on there, Satan was making an attempt to pollute the line of the seed. Because if they had really agreed to that and began to intermarry with this people, then eventually there'd be no more Jewish people. There'd be some half-breeds, and eventually there wouldn't even be half-breeds. And this is a problem not only historically with the Jewish people, but it's a problem we have to watch out for as believers. Because, you know, in the Bible where it says, be not unequally yoked with unbelievers, I believe that the most immediate context there has to deal with worship. That's what Paul is discussing there. But the basic principle behind it is applicable to all human relationships. For example, if you have an opportunity to go into business with someone, and it looks like it's really a good idea, but they're not a believer, you've got to say to yourself, as good as this looks, there's got to be problems somewhere down the road where I'm either going to have to compromise my faith or we'll have problems in the partnership. Of course, another place is in marriage. For a believer to marry a non-believer, how can you agree on anything? How are you going to raise your children and so forth? So that's what was going on there. So Jacob was obedient. He journeyed to Haran, where his relatives were. And this is kind of like almost a repeat of what happened with, remember, Eliezer, Abraham's trusted servant. And Abraham said to his trusted servant, don't take a wife for my son from this land on which we live, but go to where my relatives live and get a wife for him there. And of course, when you read the narrative, even places where God's not named, not mentioned, you can see that all that happened was not coincidental. It's just everything fits together too perfectly. That he should say, you know, when prosper Abraham when the woman you want for him comes, let me know she's the one by, and he gives a sign to look for. And sure enough, Rachel comes, and she fits perfectly with Eliezer's prayer to the Lord. And sure enough, not only that, but she was from Abraham's family. Laban was a member of Abraham's family. So now here we have a similar situation, but instead of Isaac sending a servant to get a wife, he just said to his son Jacob, you go and get a wife from among our relatives. And Jacob was obedient to that. So he journeyed to Haran. And as he was journeying, the promises that had been made to him at Bethel, remember in Bethel, where he went to sleep and God pretty much reiterated the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant for him, and he had the dream of the ladder going up to heaven. So the promises were confirmed at Bethel, and what he basically saw was that ladder going all the way from earth to heaven and the angels of God going up and down the ladder. And the basic message to Jacob was, Jacob wasn't in the land right now. So he was, and rightfully so, a little nervous. He's a stranger in that land. He has no allies or anything. But that dream that he had basically gave Jacob a very important message, No matter where you go, I will be with you. And God said that as well, and bring you back to your land. And that ladder actually was what we call a type. If we discuss types, what a type is, it's similar to a foreshadow of something that will happen in the New Testament. Well, that ladder is a type or a foreshadow of Jesus. Because remember when Nathanael came to Jesus in John 1 and Jesus said to him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed in whom is no guile." And Nathanael said, "How do you know me?" He said, "When you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Doesn't say what he was doing under the fig tree, but whatever it was, Nathanael responded by saying, "You are the Son of God. You're the King of Israel." And Jesus responded to that by saying, "You believe because I saw you under the tree, you will see greater things than this." And then he said, "You shall see the sons of the angels going up and down on the Son of God." The Son of God is the ladder. And there's only one ladder. The Son of God is the only connection. That's the importance of the ladder. The only connection between humanity and the God that created humanity. I mean, think about it. If you're, you want to fix your roof, and it's, let's say it's a three-story building, you first have to get up onto the roof. And I personally would not want to try to climb up a wall of bricks. You need a ladder. And if you get one ladder that's tall enough, problem solved. The same thing is true with Yeshua. One Savior did all the work necessary for us to get up and, as it were, climb a ladder into heaven and have a relationship with God. But another thing that's important for believers is what God was showing Jacob in this dream applies to all believers as well. No matter where we go, you know, what if God called us to a foreign country? I get a little nervous. I didn't speak the language. I'm not familiar with the culture. But if God was sending me, he would be with me. And I'd like to read something to you. It's in the book of Psalms. Psalm 139. And in Psalm 139, listen to what it says. This is a psalm of David. It was actually a song, because it says in the title, "For the Choir Director." So this would be a song. "O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down. You are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all." He knows what we're going to say before we do. And that really refutes, I think you remember I mentioned that relatively new theology called openness, the openness of God, which teaches that God does not know the future thoughts, words, or events of people. And he does that, well, they do that in order to try and skirt the free will issue. But right here, David is saying, you know what I'm going to say before I say it. Now going to verse 7, "Where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there." And that right there is a literary technique used by the ancient Jewish people. And basically speaking, what he's doing is he's taking the two extremes. in one direction, the extreme is heaven, and in the other direction, the is Sheol. And everything exists between those two points. And basically speaking, what David says is, no matter where I go, you're there. I can go all the way up, go all the way down. Doesn't matter where I go. Okay? That's called a merism, by the way. When somebody takes two extremes like that, it's called a merism. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to you, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike for you. And so if you were on a journey and you were hurried, you had to hurry along, and you didn't have time to set up a little camp for yourself and sleep for the night and then continue in the morning, you had to walk through the night. That can be scary in a forest or so forth. But whereas you can't see your way, God sees just as well in the darkness as he does in the light. It makes no difference. It's all the same to him. Okay? For you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. That's something for those who believe in abortion as a form of birth control to meditate on. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. That phrase, depths of the earth, is an idiom for a place of safety. And a mother's womb is a place of safety for the first 9 months of a child's birth, of a child's life. It's a place of safety for the child. And then moving down just a little bit, and this, don't pray this prayer unless you're ready. I'm serious now because I've experienced. Don't pray this prayer unless you're ready for God to work in your life, and it may be painful. It ends, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. So that psalm is a beautiful commentary on what we're talking about here. It doesn't matter where Jacob goes. It doesn't matter where we go. God is always with us. You can't hide from God. Now, of course, the other side of that coin is, it's a warning to the unbeliever. No matter where you go and what you do, God sees. All things are naked and open to him with whom we have to do. So when an unbeliever does wrong and says, I got away with it, there's no such thing. There's no such thing as I got away with it, because God is going to bring all things into judgment. So anyway, Jacob meets Rachel, and interestingly enough, he meets her at a well, just like Eliezer met Rebecca. And there's a series of coincidences that take place that are so dramatic that if you just look at it objectively, although what happens at that well is not specifically attributed to God, it's clear that he's working in the affairs of men. So Jacob meets Rachel there, and he moves the stone so she can water her sheep. And then when he gets into a conversation with her, and Jacob finds out that she is who she is, that she's the daughter of Laban, there's no coincidences in the kingdom of God. And Jacob went and stayed with Laban. And then you know the story of how he had two daughters and he wanted to marry Rachel, but Laban deceived him, and he married Leah first. So he had to work another 7 years to get Rachel. Now, one of the things that we see happening here in this family, including Laban and his immediate family, and I'm also talking about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the sons of Jacob, this was an extremely dysfunctional family. Extremely dysfunctional family. And the thing that shows us that this family was dysfunctional most clearly is everything was built on deceit and lies. Laban lied to Jacob. Jacob lied to his father. As a matter of fact, when Jacob went to Laban and made this deal with him for his daughter, he was getting what we would call retributive discipline. What he had done wrong to Esau and to his own father, remember the deceit? He was just getting it back. That's called retribution. And so this family would have fallen apart if not for the grace of God. You know, for all we know, Esau quite possibly may have killed Jacob if not for the grace of God. And so we have to remember, it's not biblical. I mean, it's biblical, it's not in the Bible, but you know where Shakespeare says, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." And one of the things that's true about lying, it almost always puts you in a position where you have to tell another lie, or you'll be discovered. And then another one, and another one, and you wind up with this house, you know, a house of cards. And eventually, one of the lies doesn't work, and all house of cards come tumbling down. So the truth of the matter is, if you do something wrong, and there's going to be some consequences for it, and you have an urge to lie about it, trust me, whatever consequences you face because you lied about it, whatever consequences you would face, I'm sorry, if you told the truth, deal with it, consequences done, the consequences will always inevitably be worse if you lie. And the fact of the matter is, in Proverbs, listen to what it says. Proverbs 26, and in Proverbs 26, verse 19, listen to what it says. Go back, first let's go back to 18. "Like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man who deceives his neighbor." That's how serious it is. You see the word "like" there, so that's a simile. Okay? The man who deceives his neighbor is not literally someone throwing firebrands, arrows, and death, but that's the comparison that he's making. And then if we go to Proverbs 21:28, and there's a reason I'm emphasizing this, but if we go to Proverbs 21:28, "A false witness will perish, but the man who listens to the truth will speak forever." And it seems when you read the Bible, I mean, we know that all sin separates from God. There's no question about that. But at the same, in the same way, though, that doesn't make all sin the same. If you commit one sin during your lifetime, of course, we all commit more, and that sin is stealing a pack of gum, And someone else commits one sin during their lifetime, and that sin is murder. Well, both the thief and the murderer will be eternally separated from God, short of salvation. And James said, if you break one point of the law, you've broken the whole thing. However, we do have to recognize that although all sin separates from God, there are sins that are more heinous to God than others. And it seems as though God really is insulted and has a hatred for deceit. And I'll show you why. There's a kind of a good explanation in here as we read the narrative. In the book of John, Jesus is having one of his debates or conversations with his detractors, and in 8, this is what he says in verse 44. He's speaking to the Jewish leaders. You are of your father the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. It's true of all unbelievers. He was a murderer from the beginning. Now, what's Jesus talking about there? When Adam and Eve fell, because he's the one who set the ball rolling. But listen what he says. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth. Now, why is Jesus equating murder with lying? And the fact of the matter is, deceiving someone in some cases can result in murder. That's not that unusual amongst human beings. And the fact of the matter is, Satan murdered the human race with a lie. That's not to take the responsibility away from Adam and Eve. What they did was certainly wrong. So all I'm trying to emphasize is tell the truth. When I was a young boy, I was a handful. Let me tell you that. Nothing made my father more upset with me than my lying to him. And he always knew when I was lying. I don't know what it was. He could look right in my eyes and see it. And that made him more upset. He said to me, look, if you do something wrong, pay the consequences, but don't lie. You'll only make it worse for yourself, and I'll know. And as a young boy, I was a liar. Most children are. You do something wrong, I didn't know it, but I have learned from hard experience that it's better to tell the truth and face the consequences for the wrong you've done than to lie and find yourself stuck in a spider's web. Okay. Now, in your notes, we're on page 114. And we're down where it says the expansion of the family seed. This is going to be pretty much kind of like, not the beginning, but one of the big steps in fulfilling God's promise to Abraham. I will make you a mighty nation. Because you see, Jacob's going to have a number of sons that will comprise the 12 tribes of Israel. But when we read this, and we're going to read in just a minute, from man's point of view, all of these children that came, and they came in rapid succession, unlike Sarah, who waited for years to have a child, they came in rapid succession. From man's point of view, it was sibling rivalry and jealousy on the part of Leah and Rachel. They were competing with one another for their husband's affection. But from God's point of view, in spite of what they were doing, right or wrong, God had a divine agenda to grow a nation, and that he would do. Here's an interesting question. Suppose you kind of became friendly with someone, and they're a believer, and they have an idea to go into a business with you. What is one way you can tell whether this person is a man of integrity and is a man who keeps his word and a man who walks with God? Well, the answer is, don't even look at him. Look at his family. If his wife feels protected and trusts her husband and the children are being brought up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, that's a mark for the husband. If his marriage is in disarray and his children are juvenile delinquents, that's the husband's responsibility. When two people are thinking about getting married, quite often they don't take into consideration marriage is not only the joining of two people, it's the joining of two families. And so you want to get to know the family as well as getting you know, if my daughter's an adult now, but still. And she's pretty serious with this one guy now, and he's a nice fellow, I've met him. But if my daughter were to say to me, I'd like to marry so-and-so, and I'd like to have your approval, I would want to meet him and ask him some questions. For example, I will give you permission to marry my daughter under one condition. And he'd say, what is that? And I'd say, that you read and follow the Bible every day. Larry Feldman said that to the man who wanted to marry his daughter, Rebecca. And the man said to Larry, I already do that. And that was good. That's it. But I wouldn't want my daughter to marry a man who doesn't even know what the first book of the Bible is, God's plan of salvation. Okay, so the expansion of the family seed. And we're going to do a little bit of reading now. 29. We want to be in chapter 29. You'll notice I'm really stressing this honesty stuff. The destructiveness of deceit cannot be measured. There's no such thing as a white lie. All lies are red, dripping with blood. That's the truth. Okay, so we want to go to 29, verse 31. I'm going to read a little bit. Now, this is after Jacob is now married to Leah and Rachel. By the way, did I tell you, just so you know, let me put this here for a minute. Let's say this is our starting point, and this is a timeline. Right? So Jacob, this is right around when he thought he was going to be marrying Rachel, but Laban deceived him. He had agreed to work, so he's married to Leah right here, right? Now he has to work for 7 years. That's the payment for marrying Laban's daughter Leah. Jacob discovers it's Leah. What a shock that must have been. So he goes to Laban, and Laban uses his excuse. It is our custom that the older has to be married before the younger. And if you want my daughter Rachel, you got to work another 7 years for her. But he didn't marry Rachel over here. He did marry Rachel. He did take her for a wife right there. And then he had to work another 7 years. So it's not like he had to work for 4 years before he was married to Rachel. They both became his wife at pretty much the same time. And as I'm sure you're aware, Rachel was Jacob's favorite. And Leah felt unloved. Okay. So, now the Lord saw Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Leah conceived and bore a son and named him Reuben, for she said, "Because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me." And we'll see it when we get to the notes. All these names have meanings. We've talked about that. They all have meanings that relate to what's going on at the time. Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, "Because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also." So she named him Simon. She conceived again and bore a son and said, "Now this time my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him three sons." Therefore he was named Levi. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, "This time I will praise the Lord." Therefore she named him Judah. And then she stopped bearing. So it seems from reading this as though she had a child every year. It seems as though it was a short period of time. Okay. Now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister. And she said to Jacob, and this is just the way this family was, where she comes with this one, "Give me children or else I die." Poor Jacob. He's stuck in the middle of this thing. Then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" She said, "Here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her that she may bear on my knees, and through her I may have children." That's like what happened with Hagar. Remember? Sarah was barren, so she gave Abraham her maid Hagar. And in that culture, in that time, that was a form of surrogacy. The child that the maid would bear would be the child of Sarah, not of Hagar. And the same thing would happen here. Rachel's maid Bilhah would be kind of like a surrogate. So she gave her maid Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob went into her. Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, "God has vindicated me and has indeed heard my voice and has given me a son." Therefore she named him Dan. Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. So Rachel said, "With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed." And she named him Naphtali. When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. See, this is like some kind of sick competition these people are in. I mean, to think of a woman wanting to get pregnant for no other reason than she wants to have more children than her sister doesn't speak well of her and what she'll probably be like as a mother. But that's what happened. Then Leah said, "How fortunate." So she named him Gad. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob another son. I don't know if Jacob knew the names of all these kids. Then Leah said, "Happy am I, for women will call me happy." So she named him Asher. Again, we're going to go into what these names mean in a few minutes. Now, in the days of the wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. They believed in those days that mandrakes were like kind of like an aphrodisiac, and they could make someone fertile. So Rachel says to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But she said to her, is it a small matter for you to take my husband? And would you take my son's mandrakes also? So here's their bargaining. So Rachel said, therefore he may lay with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes. Apparently, at nighttime, Jacob preferred to sleep with Rachel. She was his favorite. But Rachel said, give me some of those mandrakes and you go sleep with him tonight. So then Leah said, verse 15. When Jacob came in from the field in the evening, here's poor Jacob, la-di-da-di-da. He doesn't know anything about any of this. When Jacob came in from the field in the evening, then Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. So he lay with her that night. This is some culture. I don't know. It's just different time. It is contrary to what Moses would have had them to do, because in the book of Genesis, it seems pretty clear that marriage is a one man, one woman, institution. Leah conceived again and bore a sixth son to Jacob. Then Leah said, God has endowed me with a good gift. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have bore him six sons. So she named him Zebulun. Afterwards, she bore a daughter and named her Dinah. Then God remembered Rachel, and God gave heed to her and opened her womb. So she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. She named him Jacob, saying, may the Lord give me another son. So you can see what's happening here. Because of the jealousy and the sibling rivalry, that probably was nothing new to these sisters, they are both competing for Jacob's affection, and the way they both feel they can win it is to give him more children. And in Psalms it says, children are a gift from the Lord. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. So, going to the notes, the expansion of the family seed, the desire for affectionate approval often leads down dangerous paths. The contest of childbearing between Rachel and Leah shows such a struggle within the family. This story is about the craving of human beings for love and recognition and the price of thwarting it. And the fact of the matter is, I would tend to say right up there with lying is jealousy. Now there's two words that are closely associated with one another, just so we don't get confused. When God says, I am a jealous God, that doesn't take on the same meaning as Rachel was jealous of Leah. So what I like to do, just for the sake of clarity, is there's jealousy and there's envy. And here's the difference. If you have something and I want it, and I'm jealous, I'll find a way to take it away from you or I'll destroy it. That's human nature. If you have something and I'm envious of it, I'll say, I want one of those too, and I'll go out and work and earn enough money to buy it. So envy can be a healthy thing. It can motivate me to do right. But jealousy is always destructive. Leah's first four sons were born in rapid succession, and this must be contrasted with the long waits of the earlier fathers. The story of these births is sad, but in them As in the chapter as a whole, God is recognized as the one who gives life in spite of human efforts. And you know when they say, when it says God closed the wombs of all the people in the city and he opened Rachel's womb and so forth, we need to recognize that we know that the way the human race functions is a man and a woman have sexual intercourse and they have children. Some women are barren, some men don't produce sperm. But a human effort to take a barren woman and enable her to give birth to a child is very unhealthy. There are women who sell their eggs to an egg bank. And I knew one once. And she had to take these drugs to make her real frown. I don't know what she was doing, but she was like a lunatic from these drugs. God is the one who opens and closes wombs. Man should not fiddle around with what is God's job. Okay. Leah, next page. Leah named her firstborn Reuben, indicating that the Lord had seen her misery. Rahabani, another word play, joins it. Now at last my husband will become attached, ye Abahani, to me. So you can see how his name is almost exactly the same as, it's a play on words there. To play on words there. Simon was so named because the Lord heard, Sama, that Leah was not loved. God heard her testimony in faith, and his provision, compared to Ishmael, means God hears. Levi was named for her hope that her husband would become attached, Yilwah, to her, but it was not to be. Judah was her consolation. She would be satisfied to praise Odeh. For Judah means, let him be praised. Leah exhibited genuine faith during her great affliction. And we can see that it doesn't seem as though, it seems as though Leah had a problem with her sister. Because her sister did seem to lord it over her that she was the favored. But it also seems that Leah was a godly woman. She didn't get involved in deceit, you know, but she did get caught up in this wild contest of who's going to have more children. Okay, so that's chapter 29. And we'll take our first break there, and then we'll start on chapter 30. Now, so we're still talking about the expansion of the family of Jacob. Don't forget, in the original writings, there were no chapter divisions. And so they were added later. So every once in a while, you'll get a story that leaps, you know, that starts in one chapter and ends in another. But we're up to chapter 30 right now. And we're going to be reading about the expansion of the family. Now, we're not going to read chapters 1 through 24. I'm just going to make a summary statement about that. Then we'll go over it in little chunks. In chapter 29, 31 through 35, Moses recorded the births of Jacob's first four sons through his wife Leah: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Okay, then read with me verses 1 through 8. Now, when Rachel saw that she... I read that. Read it again. Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister, and she said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." My wife ever said to me something like that, I think I'd die. Then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" She said, "Here is my maid Bilhah." Bilhah must have had a lot of self-esteem. "Go into her that she may bear on my knees, that through her I too may have children." So she gave him her maid Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob went into her. Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, "God has vindicated me and has indeed heard my voice and has given me a son." Therefore she named him Dan. Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. So Rachel said, "With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister." She recognized what was going on. She wasn't in any kind of denial. "And I have prevailed." So she named him Naphtali. Okay, let's go over to the notes. The sons of Rachel through Bilhah. And again, remember, this is all strange to us now. But back in those days in the ancient Middle East, it wasn't strange to them at all. In the Middle East, what Jacob was doing, actually what his wives were doing in the Middle East, is comparable to modern day surrogacy. You know, there's women who are surrogate and they carry the baby. Okay. So I couldn't hear you. Okay, the sons of Rachel through Bilhah. Rachel was barren. She was jealous of Leah's fertility, felt wronged over her barrenness, and blamed Jacob for the fact she had not given him any children. What she didn't recognize was her issue was with God, not with her husband. Only God has the ability to create life. So she had it a little bit wrong there, and that's, Jacob was right. So am I in the place of God? And the thing that's ironic here and sad is, if what Jacob really should have done is called his wives over. Leah, Rachel, God has made a promise. He made it to Abraham, my grandfather. He made it to my father, and now it's been passed down to me, that I will be the father of many nations. Let's trust God. That should have been, but they didn't want to trust God. They wanted to take it upon themselves to accomplish it. The end result would have been the same if they had trusted God. In fact, it would have been better, because God's way is always better, but they decided to take the reins into their own hands. In order to compensate for her barrenness, Rachel gave her maid Bilhah to Jacob as his wife. She reasoned that any children born to Jacob through Bilhah would be the equivalent of children she had born. This was an ancient, misguided form of surrogacy. Whereas Leah exhibited genuine faith during her great affliction, and if you think about it, Leah must have been a very happy, unhappy woman in the earlier days of her marriage. You know, I know that as a general rule, let's put it this way, I was once watching Everybody Loves Raymond, and they did this flashback to when they were living in an apartment and they become engaged. Everybody familiar with that show? Everybody Loves Raymond? They become engaged at the apartment, and Raymond's mother comes over, and they give him the good news. So all of a sudden, Raymond's wife gets out all these bridal magazines and this and that. And it's like she's been planning a wedding. He said, "What are you doing? Where did you get all that stuff?" And her answer to him, "I've been planning this wedding since I was 5 years old." And that's what it's like. I mean, I know that one of the things that give women great joy is when they're pregnant and they take a room and get it ready for the baby. It's a time of joy for a woman. Whereas Leah exhibited genuine faith during her great affliction, Rachel's son through Bilhah did not reflect the faith Leah had. Her attempt to have children through her maidservant reflects Sarah's similar attempt with Hagar. The big difference is that when push came to shove, I like that expression, Abraham and Sarah did trust God. Their faith floundered a little bit because they had some maturing to do. You remember when Abraham said, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." But Rebecca and ultimately Leah didn't trust God, and they took this upon themselves. Bilhah gave Jacob two sons. The names of the two sons born to Bilhah reflect Rachel's bitter struggle and a feeling of victory. The name Dan is explained by the word Danity. God has vindicated me, that he is now, that he, see where it says that he is, the word is should not be there. Just cross it out. That he now had corrected Rachel's wrong, her barrenness. The name Naphtali reflects her great struggle. Naphtali, when I fought with my sister. Okay? And what you can see happening here again is children being named. Sometimes children are named prophetically. You see that, like Noah. Sometimes children are named by certain circumstances surrounding their birth. The major example of that is when the angel says to Joseph, "You shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins." Jesus is not a translation, it's a transliteration. Everybody familiar with that concept? Anybody not? Okay, Jesus is a transliteration of the Greek word Jesus. You see how they sound a lot like one another. And the Greek word Jesus is a translation of the Hebrew word Yeshua. And the word Yeshua, translated into English, is God saves. So you can see the connection there. You shall name him God saves, for he will save his people from their sins. So that's the primary example of naming a child after their destiny. Okay. The children of Leah through Zilpah. There's no way Jacob knew the names of all his children. He probably spent as much time out in the field as he could. Okay, verses 9 through 13. When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, "How fortunate." So she named him Gad. And I'll tell you, Gad means with fortune. So you can see how it reflects what was on her mind. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, "Happy am I, for women will call me happy So she named him Asher. And the word Asher translates into the word happy. Okay, going to the notes. Leah responded to what Rachel had done by offering her maidservant Zilpah, to whom Gad, fortune, and Asher, blessing, were born. Leah saw that with God's help, she was prospering. She's the only one who really acknowledged that God was involved in any of this. They were all believers. But sometimes believers live as though they weren't. That's what's happening in this family. Yes? Judah. Judah is what we call the royal line. The royal line passes through Judah. And the key scripture for that is Genesis 49:10. Okay, more children through Rachel. Verses 14-21. Now in the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother, Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." But she said to her, "Is it too small? Is it a small matter for you to take my husband? And you would take my son's mandrakes as well?" So does this remind you of anything? Yes. When Esau came in and says, "Let me have some of that stuff there." But what is it they say? The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So now, picture this in your mind. Here's Jacob's out in the field, probably praying, "Lord, I got to go home now. Let me make it through the night. This is just, it's getting to me." So Jacob, no idea what's going on, comes walking home to the tent. So Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." But she said to her, "Is it a small matter for you to take my husband? And would you take my son's mandrakes also?" So Rachel said, "Therefore he may lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes." It's almost a repeat of what happened with Jacob and Esau. God is a jealous God, visiting the sins of the parents to the third and fourth generation. When Jacob came in from the field in the evening, then Leah went out to meet him and said, "You must come into me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes." So he lay with her that night. Jacob, he seems like by this time he's just passive. Who's tonight? You know? He's got these four women. He never knows. From one day to the other, he walks over to his tent and says, "Who's in there?" You know? Okay. God gave heed to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Then Leah said, "God has given me my wages." Because I gave my maid to my husband. So she named him Issachar.
Was that from Leah or from Zilpah?
I can't hear you. Well, it wasn't from Leah, it was from her maid. Yeah. But then Leah conceived again and bore a sixth son to Jacob. Then Leah said, "God has endowed me with a good gift. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons." So she named him Zebulon. Afterwards, she bore a daughter and named her Dinah. Then God remembered Rachel, and God gave heed to her and opened her womb. So she conceived and bore a son and said, "God has taken away my reproach." She named him Joseph, saying, "May the Lord give me another son." Literally, it's "add to me another son." Okay? So, top of page 117, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, found some mandrake plants, which were supposedly aphrodisiacs, and Rachel thought that they would work for her. Thus, Leah hired Jacob with the plants, that is, purchased a night with Jacob from Rachel. Thus, Leah had a son named Issachar. Issachar is explained by Squarticum, "my hire," because she received her wages. The name of Leah's sixth and final son was Zebulon. Zebulon has a double significance of dowry or gift, as well as honor. Leah said God gave her Zebulon as a gift, and her husband would now treat her with honor. These women were sadly mistaken that they thought they could win their husband's affection by bearing as many children as possible. And they were wrong in thinking that you can do that. And had they been right, that's not a very healthy way to try to win your husband's affection, even if it seems to work. Another child through Rachel. Finally, Rachel gave birth to Yosef, but not by the mandrakes. This shows that births are given by God, not manipulated by people. Joseph's name, like Zebulun's, had a double meaning. Rachel said, "God has taken away Asaph, my disgrace," and she prayed that God would add Yosef, another son. Finally, Rachel was jubilant, looking in faith for another child from God. Okay, some observations. I have two sisters. I'm a neurotic human being. I did know a family once. I did know this in high school, this girl and her brother. I knew them. And their parents had 12 sons and then finally her and one daughter. And no one in the high school ever gave her any trouble. You know how guys are sometimes wild or something. Not with 12 brothers. Okay, observations. This passage is a combination of small narratives extending the puns on Jacob's sons' names. Each name was interpreted by Leah or Rachel to reflect concrete family conditions at the price of the pious substance which they had as testimonies to God as the giver of life. Certainly the passage shows how God prospered Jacob and started to make from them a great nation. And again, the sad thing is, he would have made from them a great nation had they waited on him instead of taking the job upon themselves. To Israel, these narratives are more than interesting little stories. You always got to remember, this is being written to the Jewish people who left and are traveling in the wilderness, and also Jewish people later, even in the days of David. To Israel, these narratives are more than interesting little stories. The rivalry that appears here explains much of the tribal rivalry that followed. And there was war. They wiped out one of the tribes. Remember that? But Genesis is clear. God chose the despised mother, Leah, and exalted her to be the first mother. The kingly tribe of Judah and the priestly tribe of Levi trace back to her in spite of Jacob's love for Rachel and her son Joseph. And one of the themes that we see in the Bible is what theologians call the great reversal. And the great reversal is expressed, for example, in Beatitudes. Those who weep now will show happiness later. Those who are poor will be rich. It's the great reversal. The way our culture and past cultures have measured joy and prosperity and so forth, it's the exact upside down of what God says it is. And so this was an example of a great reversal. Okay, verses 25 to 36. Is that right? What I think we'll do now is that'll be the second, because the next section is a little on the long side. So we'll end the class here. Give me one second.